the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. I'm pleased to have Sean Levy as my guest this week. He is a film historian and critic and author of five excellent books on some of my favorite topics. His books include King of Comedy, a biography of Jerry Lewis, a book about swinging London in the 1960s, and a book about the Rat Pack. His new book is called Paul Newman, A Life. Sean Levy, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Oh, thanks very much.
Now, when you choose a topic for a book, is your first thought, what will Gary Shapiro like?
Well, if you are a million people, yeah.
Oh.
You know, really, my first thought is, what can I live with for, you know, the 3 to 5 years I'm going to be thinking and writing and reading about this subject and talking to people about the subject? And then you also have to find a hole on the bookshelf. And in the case of Paul Newman, shockingly, there hadn't been a book since 1996, and there were two then, and one was pretty scurrilous, and the other was more of a coffee table book than a biography. And there really hadn't been a proper biography since, boy, about 73. So I thought that was a gaping hole on the bookshelf, and I determined to fill it.
So obviously you began work on this book long before Paul Newman's death last year.
Yeah, a few years. I started around Thanksgiving time of 2005, and most of the time that it was public knowledge that he was ill, I was writing, but I had been doing my research for several years before that, and he passed away while I was still working on the manuscript, and it added a lot of information comes out when a person dies, public records that you need permission to search for during the person's life become available to anyone after they pass, military records, things of this nature. So it added to the workload, and it unfortunately gave me an ending.
Right.
But, you know, he was an elderly man when I started. I mean, you know, I wish he was still around, calling me up and telling me what I got wrong.
Well, did he participate in the book at all?
He didn't. Very graciously. I spoke to Newman's representatives, I think, three different times, immediately upon getting the contract from a publisher, and then twice at least after that. I sent them the book proposal. I had nothing to hide. My work is well known. I've been, a film critic for 22 years, and I wanted, if nothing else, just to fax him a few questions of fact. But he very graciously, through his publicist, you know, gave me a formal statement explaining that that he and his wife no longer would entertain interviews or accept honors or any of those sorts of things.
Right. Well, now that the book has come out, have you heard from Paul Newman's family, or have they received the book well, or do you know?
I don't know. The initial splash the book made was because the New York Post publicized some of the more sensational aspects of it, and they're only moderately sensational in my view. And at that time, we heard from the Newman's new publicist, the publicist whom I was in contact with has also passed away. And they asked for copies, and we sent them copies immediately, and we've never heard back, and that's about 5 months ago now.
Well, speaking of unflattering things, of which there's very little that's unflattering about Paul Newman in the book,
mm-hmm.
But your book on Jerry Lewis, if you don't mind talking about that a little bit also, King of Comedy, The Life and Art of Jerry Lewis, it's a classic, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
It was fairly critical of Jerry, whereas your Newman book is less so. I mean, can you compare the experience of researching the two lives?
Well, Jerry Lewis did participate in my book, and I had some hair-raising encounters with him, and he eventually withdrew from participating in the book. But the main thing is that it gets back almost to the initial question, what sort of person is it that is inhabiting your head? And even though they both did a lot of charity work, Newman sort of walked that walk more so than Jerry Lewis. Jerry Lewis in person is a different character from on screen, whether you're talking about the movies or you're talking about the telethon. And Paul Newman, by eyewitness testimony, by the record that he left, by everything that I learned, pretty much was Paul Newman. At first, I thought it wouldn't be much of a book because he didn't have masks that he hid behind. But, you know, I found that the plain humanity of the man was a good story and a good subject to write about in itself. Jerry's a complex guy who hides a lot of his darkness and has a lot of darkness.
It's interesting because they were both stars at the same time, although Paul Newman's star, you know, was kind of rising as Jerry's was falling. But they both were big in the 60s and both making films at the same time, although they never worked together. I don't think they were in any picture together.
No.
Although you never know with those all-star kinds of things. I don't think Jerry was in the... He was the only person left out of the Towering Inferno, I believe.
Yeah, no, he
and he's mad.
His life was a disaster movie at that phase.
But, you know, Newman is a very private guy. He rarely signed autographs. And yet you did uncover some private things about him. Want to discuss a little bit about the research that you went into?
Well, someone who's 80 years old and has lived in public for more than 50 years leaves a huge paper trail. He's, you know, even though everyone says, boy, you know, Newman hardly ever gave interviews. Well, I beg to differ. He gave thousands, maybe tens of thousands of interviews back to 1953, 54, and really right up until 2007, right before he became ill. You know, if he had normally a philanthropic or a political cause that he was getting behind, he would grant an interview. His name would draw attention to the thing he was interested in, and he took advantage of that in a positive way. So there were lots of interviews that you could look at, and some of them had been published very widely, you know, in national magazines, Time, Playboy, Rolling Stone. Some of them were published in regional newspapers, and, you know, I've been a journalist a long time. I know how to find those things. And I found some unpublished interviews. I found a 90-page Q&A transcript of an interview done with him backstage on Broadway in 1959 that went into great detail about his childhood and upbringing.
Wow.
So those sort of things. There were people to talk to. And then there were the sort of public or even in some cases private documents that people leave behind that, again, I used some of my journalistic training to find. So I went to Kenyon College in Gambier, Ohio, his alma mater, and asked if they had any papers. And they handed me a few, you know, sort of legal file boxes. And in one of them was his handwritten application from 1946 describing his young life. I did a dance when they gave me that. You know, that's solid gold. I found an archive in Cleveland where he grew up that included letters that he'd written to his uncle over a period of years. So I had, you know, Newman's handwriting and his voice in the book, you know, things that had never been seen by any of the other people who'd written about him. So that, you know, the combination of talking to people, doing primary archive work, and then, you know, going thoroughly through the written record that he left, which was pretty big, and in fact, tape-recorded record. One of the most interesting facts I found was from an interview he did on National Public Radio with Terry Gross, where he said that when he was in the Navy, he smuggled whiskey onto the base in Bremerton, Washington. He said it. You know, it must be true, and if it's a lie, it's one he was happy to spread, so it was in bounds.
We're talking to Sean Levy, and his new book is a biography of Paul Newman, Paul Newman Alive. Well, so did you find as you read these interviews over, you know, his long life that his philosophies changed, his points of views changed?
Yeah. You know, a lot of the interviews had to do with his craft, the craft of acting, and his attitude toward acting definitely changed. As a young man, he was a very zealous convert to the Method School of Acting. He studied at the Actor's Studio with Lee Strasberg, the great temple of method acting in American theater and cinema. And he was a real advocate for that. And as he specialized in Hollywood commercial, big money Hollywood movies, he began to become an ironist more as a performer rather than an emoter. And his attitude toward acting changed. He saw it more as a business. And then later in life, he evolved again, and he embraced the craft of it more. He was starting to direct movies. He was being more selective about the films that he made and appeared in. He became a little more involved in the theater as a director and a patron, a donor to theater. And that was really interesting to see, how his attitude toward, you know, the thing that made him most famous and the thing that really consumed him. He was a great student of his craft. And over the decades, you know, his studies led him to different beliefs.
And your book sort of points out that there's sort of distinct phases in his career. There's his sort of the method actor, the young method actor, somebody up there likes me, and then the huge star of the Cool Hand Luke era, and then, as you were just mentioning, the kind of older thoughtful performer of The Verdict and Nobody's Fool. Your book seems to say that, tell me if I'm wrong, that the death of his son affected his acting, made him a more thoughtful actor, maybe?
Oh, I absolutely believe that. You know, there were four films around the time. His son Scott died in 1978 at the age of 28 of a drug overdose. Scott was a very troubled young man, and he even tried to become an actor. And, you know, that's like Babe Ruth's kid trying to be, you know, an outfielder. I mean, it's just, it's too much to live up to. And Scott, after Scott passed, you know, the last hit that Newman had before Scott's death was Slapshot. And he was 52 or so when he made that film. And he was skating around with guys a third of his age, guys 10 years younger than Scott. And boozing and brawling and cussing and just having a great time. And he totally seemed the part of an overage teenager. And then Scott passed, and there were a couple of contractual obligation pictures in there. But then after Scott's death, the films that he made were Fort Apache, The Bronx, Absence of Malice, The Verdict, and The Color of Money. And none of those resembles Slapshot. And none of those characters in any way is a superannuated kid. They're men who've suffered. And Newman played those roles in a more compact style. There was no winking at the audience, as you see in The Sting or Slapshot, which were made before Scott's death. But also, after Scott's death, he began his food business, he began his charity work, he began racing professionally instead of amateur, and he was a champion amateur racer, but then he started racing as a pro and bought a racing team. So I would argue that every aspect of his life was affected in an important way by losing his son.
It's interesting. The Verdict is really the picture that sort of stands out of those that you mentioned in terms of his performance. Although he won the Oscar for The Color of Money, I think The Verdict is the one he should have won for.
Well, yeah, The Verdict is his Sistine Chapel. I mean, it's the performance there, you know, he does so much just by standing still, and that was something he really had to teach himself how to do. He was such a busy actor and such a... He was kind of a posturing actor, and I don't mean that entirely negative, because he was, A, beautiful, and, you know, we go to the movies to look at beautiful people, and, B, he was good at it. I mean, you look at Fast Eddie Felsen sort of throwing his hands on the pool table and stretching, you know, like in anguish, and it may be contrived, but it's wonderfully contrived, you know?
Mm-hmm.
The French horn is contrived, but it sounds beautiful.
Right.
And Newman could do that, but I think his training led him to want to do less as an actor, and he didn't really have that breakthrough until he was in his 50s. And once he figured out how to act, once he knew what he was doing, in his own words, he began to dislike earlier classic films like Cool Hand Luke and Hud and The Hustler. He thought they were too posed. I think he was overly critical of his earlier work, but there's definitely a difference.
Well, I do think that some of his earlier films don't quite hold up as well. Harper, for instance, although it was great, and I loved it at the time, and I liked The Drowning Pool also, but I watched it the other day, it seemed really long.
Yeah, Harper's a funny case. I think the thing that's fresh about Harper is the attitude. If you put it in 1966, it's a private eye movie, but it has a saucy kind of Sunset Strip feel to it that you didn't see in a lot of high-gloss Hollywood productions with actors the status of Paul Newman in them. You know, it still predates Bonnie and Clyde and The Graduate and Midnight Cowboy, but it's got some of the, you know, countercultural savor of those films while still being a sort of Hollywood production.
Well, you know, to some extent I would think that the change in his acting that we're talking about also had to do with the change in Hollywood. I mean, if you think of, you know, when he first arrived in Hollywood in the sort of the tail end of the studio era, when, you know, he sort of was following in the footsteps of actors like, of course, you know, Brando, but even before then, people like Henry Fonda and Gregory Peck.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, more modern day acting is quite different.
Yeah, absolutely. There was a personality-based acting style in Hollywood in the studio era. You know, someone like John Wayne or Humphrey Bogart, Cary Grant, you could accuse them sort of, you know, somewhat fairly, somewhat superficially of playing the same part all the time or playing themselves in every picture. And then with Brando, we get the idea that an actor must change and must live the part, you know, and that leads you to the Sean Penns and Johnny Depps, these people who remake themselves
in every
movie.
Meryl Streep.
De Niro, Meryl Streep, exactly. And Newman just follows Brando in. So, in the first 10 years he was in movies, he played a lot of Southerners. He played Rocky Graziano. He played a Mexican bandit. He played a French revolutionary. He tried to stretch his wings, but he really didn't realize, it took him about a dozen years to give up on that and realize he needed to play an American guy. And I think that disappointed him a little. I think that the fact that he had limits as an actor kind of, deflated him. And it wasn't until, again, the period when Scott died, when Newman was about 53, that he actually saw his limits as liberating. And he could, explore within those limits rather than be frustrated by them.
Well, we're talking with Sean Levy, and his book is called Paul Newman, A Life. And I guess, the greatest of all Paul Newman movies, in my opinion, maybe you'll disagree, we can fight about it, is Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. It's such a marvelous film. It holds up so well, and has his personality is so great, and Robert Redford, and just such a great movie. I just showed it recently to a group of people who had never seen it before, and they absolutely loved it.
Yeah, it's a lovable movie. Of his George Roy Hill films, the three, I prefer Slapshot, which has even less ambition than Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, and I kind of admire that. Slapshot's just kind of this movie about nothing that sort of just is what it is. It's so singular in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Butch Cassidy, you can see sort of Paramount pushing the thing to fit a genre and, have a more cohesive story. That said, basically the plot of that movie is two guys are chased. That's
right.
The plot. So it's nearly there. And the third film that George Roy Hill and Newman made also featured Robert Redford, The Sting. And that's the most contrived, but of course it's a plot about contrivance, con games.
And it's so great.
They're three pretty, highly ranked films in my view as well, but I'm a Slapshot man.
Now, you're unkind to one that I love, which is, we all love movies that we saw when we were a kid, but I always liked that movie, The Secret War of Harry Frigg, which you absolutely despised.
When did you see it last?
When I was 10.
Okay, all right. Catch up on that and drop me an email.
All right, I will.
If you thought Harper was a long movie.
Yes.
Ooh.
Secret War of Harry Frigg.
Harry Frigg, if you were on your deathbed and wanted it to last a good long time, you put that movie on once, you'd be begging the Grim Reaper to come for
you. It's a comedy, isn't it? He plays a funny...
Well, yeah, except for the whole making the audience laugh bit. Yeah.
Maybe he should have teamed up with Jerry Lewis.
He actually has a funny persona in The Secret War of Harry Frigg.
Mm-hmm.
It's not Newman who's the problem. It's the story and it's everyone around him. It's a really ineptly made movie, and he didn't rate it very highly either.
It's odd that some of Paul Newman's movies, and considering what a huge star he's been over the years, it's odd that so many of them are not around, unavailable, including that one, The Secret War of Harry Frigg, WUSA, Winning.
Mm-hmm. So, in some cases it's to do this is often the case with DVD and video releases of older films. They may not have bought the rights in perpetuity for the score.
Mm.
And now, there's no demand for the film, and the studio would have to go through some rigmarole to get the rights, so they just say the heck with it. Although, since Newman's death, probably three or four of the films that were never on DVD have appeared on DVD. And I think in the next couple of years we'll probably see some more of them. One screaming example is Sometimes a Great Notion.
Mm-hmm.
His adaptation, he directed it, although he filled in for someone who he fired.
He's great,
producer and
he's
star.
Great in it.
But there's wonderful things in that film. It's not a great film, but it's an estimable film. And it was only on DVD once. And a strange footnote, it was the first thing ever shown on HBO.
Oh, that's interesting. I think it's really a wonderful movie. It's
good.
It's got at least one incredibly memorable scene in the
film. The drowning of Joe Bob, and Newman trying to keep Richard Jekyll alive by diving underwater to breathe air into his lungs. Another footnote item in the book that I found, these are the things that you find when you go through written records.
Mm-hmm.
Someone saw that film, and a few years later was camping on a houseboat with his family, and his daughter got caught in the propeller under the boat, and he saved his daughter's life by diving under, breathing air into her lungs, and finally untangling her. And it was because he'd seen that movie. You know, there's not too many films you can credit with saving a human life.
Another good a wing on Paul Newman's Angel.
Yeah, feather in his cap. Inadvertent, but when it happened and it was in the papers, they mentioned Paul Newman, and that's how I found it.
Interesting. You're also not a huge fan of his collaborations with Robert Altman.
Well, I just don't think it's either man at his best. I liked Buffalo Bill and the Indians pretty well, and I spoke to people who worked on that film that felt that, you know, there was a real slip between the intent and the finished product. Quintet, the second movie he made with Altman, is dreadful. It's dreadful. That one is not on DVD and should never be on DVD. It's this weird, futuristic...
I remember that the screen was kind of like Vaseline on the sides of the screen.
Yeah. It's wrong in about 9 different ways. Nobody looks like they know what they're talking about or doing. If you're familiar with the John Boorman, Sean Connery film Zardoz, that is crystalline compared to Quintet. It's just not a good movie. Whereas Buffalo Bill and the Indians, you could see what they were up to, and you could see how they just missed it, but they still got some great stuff done.
Paul Newman looks great in Quintet, though. He's very handsome in the movie.
Well, yeah, Paul Newman looks great. As part of my research, I had to choose photos, and I literally sat at a photo agency in New York and looked at about a 4-foot-high stack of glossy photos, and he never took a bad picture.
He's the most photogenic star of all time.
There was one bad picture, and the guys who ran the photo agency and I stared at it for like a half hour, and finally we decided that it was just a lousy shot because it put a shadow over his nose. he had that in his mind. He was a lucky person because he was born with that face, that physique, that metabolism, and those eyes, and that's what made him marketable. You know, being a star.
I look a lot like him, by the way.
Oh yeah, you know, I hear that too.
So, do you think he was alcoholic?
Yeah, I think he was. He was someone who drank, by eyewitness reports, by his own testimony, by written reports. He could put away a case of beer a day, and he drank hard liquor pretty seriously for about 20 years of his life. I never heard anyone say he showed up to work drunk. He couldn't race his car because he'd been drinking. He embarrassed himself at a public function because of too much booze. But you hear people say, "Yeah, it was 10 o'clock when I showed up, and there was Newman having a Budweiser."
Hmm.
He could metabolize booze, beer mainly, better than most other people, and he really loved it. I spoke to someone who made a picture with him in Mexico in the 80s when Newman was in his 60s, and he said that Newman used to ride a bike in Mexico in the summer hours at a time, and said that he was doing it so he could enjoy his beers later and, you know, not suffer for it. So that sound, if you're doing hours of exercise so you can drink, that's got to be one definition of alcoholism.
I guess,
you know?
So.
But he wasn't like a sloppy drunk, or, you know, as I say, you know, it never seemed to affect his work or his racing or his public appearances.
Well, do you think he was drunk while racing? That can't be.
No. This is what I'm saying. You know, when the races were over, he'd sit and empty the cooler with the gang, but. He had a contract with Budweiser as a racer, and they paid him 10 cases of beer a week, in addition to some money, of course. But they sent 10 cases of beer a week to his house. Now, in my house, after a few weeks, we'd have a lot of Budweiser hanging around. But he went through it.
Talk a little bit about his relationship with Steve McQueen. They were rivals?
They were rivals. You know, it's funny. In Newman's breakthrough film, Somebody Up There Likes Me, Steve McQueen has one line. Back when he was being billed as Stephen McQueen. And they worked together, and then they went their separate ways, and Newman became a big star, and Steve McQueen had a slower rise. And then by the late 60s, they were, you know, two of the top, let's say, 5 or 10 best-paid actors in Hollywood. And Newman was just slightly above McQueen all the time. And I don't think Newman saw that there was a rivalry, but McQueen did. And at least one story has McQueen being considered very, very strongly for the role of the Sundance Kid in Butch Cassidy, and losing the role because he insisted on getting billing above Newman. And it wasn't so much that Newman wouldn't give up top billing, it's just that he didn't want to work with someone who saw that as a sticking point. And then a few years later, they did work together in The Towering Inferno, and some agent came up with some scheme where one guy got his billing was higher, but the other guy's was larger and more easy, you know. So, like, they came up with top billing and side larger billing or something crazy, and they did work together. And, you know, they rode motorbikes together. Steve McQueen sort of lent a hand to Scott Newman, Paul's son, early in Scott's career. I don't know that personally they disliked each other, but they, you know, at least in McQueen's eyes, they were professional rivals, and it prevented them from working together.
And they were both interested in racing. I know McQueen made at least one racing movie.
Right, right. And, you know, they were both serious racers. I mean, Newman, you know, he ran hundreds of auto races. He won 4 amateur national titles. He won 2 professional races. And he was in his 50s. And racing basically as a weekend racer against guys who did it for a living, he won 2 races, which is a huge achievement. And then he finished 2nd at Le Mans at age 54, and at age 70, he won the 24 Hours of Daytona, making him, at least at the time, the oldest person anywhere ever to win a professional auto race.
Someone has beat that record since?
I you know, I don't know, but I know
that
at least
going to beat that one.
Yeah, at least at the time, 70 in a 24-hour race.
Well, an amazing life. And I think some people would be surprised to learn that he had been married before.
Right. In fact, he'd been married for 9 years before he married Joanne Woodward, and he had 3 children with his first wife. He was young when he married, although not really for his generation. He was almost 25. He had a son born. He and his wife, Jackie, were both summer stock actors. He was just out of college. He was older as a college grad because he'd spent 3 years in the Pacific during World War II. While he was married, he met Joanne Woodward, and it was a long and kind of tortured courtship. She was a child of divorce, which was more unusual in her generation than it is today. And she and he just found each other. They wound up being married for 50 years, and I'm certain that even the first Mrs. Newman could see after a while that Paul and Joanne really were meant for each other, and as painful as it would have been to lose him and to lose your children's father, that this was really a storybook romance that bloomed between Paul and Joanne.
Did you interview her for your book?
No. Once, you know, the Newmans said no, and then very, you know, a circle around the Newmans, who included dozens of people I would have wanted to talk to, also graciously said, if Paul and Joanne aren't talking, sorry, but I'm not talking. And, you know, you can't get too upset with that.
Well, the book hasn't suffered for any of that. It's a fabulous book, and it's called Paul Newman, A Life, and the author is Sean Levy. Thank you for spending some time with us today.
Oh, not at all. Thank you.
Well, that closes the book on this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. Hope you enjoyed the program. I'll be back again with another great show next week. Thanks to Sean Levy for being here with us. And thanks, as always, to our From the Bookshelf staff, Miss Breanne Beal, for all of her hard work. Thanks, Breanne. Check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or find us on iTunes. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Good night, everybody.